You're listening to MLB.com Extras, brought to you by MLB.tv. It's baseball everywhere.
This is MLB.com Extras, American League Central Edition. I'm Anthony Cashman. It's going to be joined by all the beat writers for MLB.com from the American League Central teams. And this is shaping up to be maybe the best division race in baseball, just because I guess the David and Goliath story it entails. When you think about the Detroit Tigers and where they are payroll-wise and where they are panache-wise, and really just a loaded team that's undergone a lot of adversity here in the second half, and they got hunted down and overtaken by a Royals team that just got hot really out of nowhere. A team you knew could be good going into the year, but they were kind of sluggish offensively for the first few months, and then really turned it on here in the second half, and really has put themselves in a position to be the best story in baseball down the stretch. So, and let's not forget about an Indians team that's kind of lurking in the shadows as well with a much improved rotation. So we'll see how that all comes together, and we'll talk about that all. So thank you for tuning in, and here's MLB.com Extras, American League Central. I'm going to be joined by Dick Cagle, the Royals beat reporter for MLB.com. And, you know, every great story in baseball and sports in general kind of needs those seminal moments or seminal moments. And the Royals just might have had theirs Tuesday night with a bloop and a blast late to beat the Twins, and Alex Gordon with a walk-off home run on a night that had looked lost. And it just kind of sums up, I guess, the way things have been going for the Royals and generally these last few weeks. Let's bring in DK to talk about that. Dick, that was obviously a special moment and by a guy who's really been a special player for the Royals and Gordon. What was your take on how that night played out, and did it kind of feel like one of those moments you remember if we get to late September and the Royals are still on top?
Yeah, that's right. And, you know, you kind of had a feeling that maybe something was going to happen, Anthony, because they'd gone – this was the third straight game in which they'd gone virtually with very little hitting. And very unlike the Royals been lately, they really came on with the offense. You know, the pitching had been so good all year, and the defense was terrific, and the base running was good, and everything was going well except for the offense. And then the offense came around, of course, during that long hot streak they had. And all of a sudden, in the last game in Texas, they scored one run. The Yankees came into town for that makeup game. They scored one run. And here they go along with the Twins, and they can't score anything. And you get to the ninth inning, and you look around, and they've got, maybe three hits, and golly, what's going on? But somehow you kind of had a feeling maybe something was going to happen. And I remember after the game last night, I was talking to Danny Duffy, who pitched, and he was in the training room with Kyle Turner, one of the trainers, and Kyle said, "How about a bloop and a blast?" You know, like you said, and sure enough, Escobar bloops one in the center field, and then Alex Gordon comes up, takes a pitch, and then boom! And the ball barely made it over the right field wall, but it was one of those moments when, wow, you know, all of a sudden things come to life there, and players go wild, the stadium goes wild, and you know, you feel like okay, now they're back with it. They had a little downtime here, and now things are going again, and on we go to September.
You try to get in the head of Royals fans, and I mean a quarter century of just, you know, difficult times and kind of the rug pulled out from under you at various times, or the old Charlie Brown with Lucy holding the football and yanking away at the last minute. They've had a lot of those moments over the years, so I'm sure there's some trauma involved with getting on board with this team. But boy, Dick, I mean, so many things have bounced their way these last few weeks, and then you look at what's gone on in Detroit. It was interesting, that win the Royals had Tuesday night was coupled with the news out of Detroit that Anibal Sanchez is probably not expected back before the end of the year. It just seems like that's the way this month has gone for the Tigers. As good as it's gone for the Royals, it's gone that bad for the Tigers. What's what's your sense of the fans kind of buying into things at this point? Are they still a little nervous, a little on edge, or what's the feeling there?
Well, I think the city's getting into it. You know, the fan base has been there throughout this whole procedure of kind of coming back to life, and you know, so they have some they had a tremendously big crowd in that Yankees makeup game on Monday night, and I think the fans are kind of slowly getting into it. You know, I think they're going to start coming out in real droves as we get into September and we go down the path toward October. That's what happened last year when the Royals made that little run for the wild card. All of a sudden, people say, "Hey, you know, this is really going to happen. This could really take place." And then they start coming out and they get into it. And I think the city is really talking about the Royals now, and they're really going to really buy into it as we turn the corner here into September.
Obviously, you know, the big home run we talked about was off the bat of Alex Gordon, and you know, he made some comments in the last week that were interesting regarding his option, and it's looking way ahead, but it's a player option for 2016. It's about $13 million, which, you know, for him might be a discount the way things are trending, especially the way things are trending in the industry with contracts. So that was interesting. But does that just kind of speak to the ownership he's taken here in Kansas City of being a part of this club and really being a leader on this club? Is that, I'm sure a lot of that goes into that thought process as well.
Oh, sure. And I think Alex Gordon is the kind of guy who would really like to spend his entire career in Kansas City. He's become part of the fabric of this team and of this community. And Alex he's a real solid guy, and you heard all the stories about how hard he works. I mean, the guy is just phenomenal. The amount of work he puts in to keeping himself in shape and ready to go. And I think when it comes down to it, he would like to stay his entire career here, as George Brett and a few others have over the years. But I think that could very well happen. But like you say, it's a couple of years down the road. And,
right.
Perhaps they can work out something as we go along here.
Yeah. DK, one last thing before we let you go. In the bullpen, and we talked about this recently, just the use of Wade Davis and Greg Holland and Kelvin Herrera, you know, that's something that's going to have to be monitored down the stretch. And Jason Frazier has really pitched well for them since coming over from the Rangers. And is he a guy who could see more and more opportunities as the next few weeks go along here?
Yeah, Frazier's been a very valuable guy. He's a one inning guy, but he can come in. He throws strikes, and he's become very dependable for him. They've got that big three in Kelvin Herrera and Wade Davis and Greg Holland. Those three guys have just been absolutely phenomenal. I mean, as Ned said the other day, you know, there are some teams that have maybe two guys like that, but you can't think of another team that has three back-end guys like that just night after night after night can be depended on like they can.
Yeah, it's such a special asset. I mean, you look at something like relief ERA, like team relief ERA, and the Royals are more like a middle-of-the-pack team in the American League, but when you're so dominant with those three guys in seventh, eighth, and ninth inning, that is beyond valuable. That for my money, it makes them probably the most dangerous bullpen in the game. But yeah, you certainly it would be nice to see Frazier maybe take some of the burden off those guys down the stretch. So I want to thank Dick Cagle for joining us.
I'm going to be joined by Jason Beck, talking about the Detroit Tigers. Who boy, this has been the definition of the August dog days up in Detroit. In fact, the Tigers have become something of an underdog the way things have played out this month with the injuries and the surge of those Royals. And let's bring in Beck to talk about that. Jason, this is I know there's been a big test of Will in that clubhouse. And even you take a night like Tuesday night where they have a nice win against the Yankees, and then mere minutes later I'm sure they saw what happened in Kansas City with Alex Gordon's walk-off home run. It's just kind of shows the stakes have really been raised in this division, haven't they?
Yeah, this is a legit race now. I don't think either of these teams are going away. I think the two series they play coming up, first at Comerica Park around Labor Day, and then back in Kansas City like a week and a half later. I think both of these are going to be pretty big. So, it's going to be fun to watch. We've kind of had some races over the last few years with the Tigers. They haven't had it easy, but to have something go down to the wire, I think is it's a change of pace.
Yeah, definitely a change of pace. And I know it doesn't help to learn Anibal Sanchez had a setback in his recovery when you couple that with what's going on with Verlander in general, and he's got an extra rest between starts. They're just trying to get him back to where he was. What's kind of the state of the rotation there? How much does the Sanchez situation hurt them right now?
I think it hurts, mainly because they don't have that logical replacement. I think when he first went down, Robbie Ray kind of fit in as that guy, even though he hadn't been doing great at Toledo. He'd been doing okay. And, the few outings he had in Sanchez's place were just, they weren't good, culminating in the debacle in Minnesota. So now we've got Kyle Lobstein filling in. And Lobstein was good, but not anything standout at Toledo. So I think everybody's kind of watching to see what this kid can do and, whether he can hold down a major league offense or at least give them a chance to win and eat up some innings. And that's really that's what he showed in the relief appearance in Minnesota, was that he can swallow some innings. And I think even if he can just do that and kind of save the bullpen a little bit, I think that that would at least be a start, and that would be something that that Ray wasn't doing before he got sent down.
Yeah, that's a big key, it seems. I mean, the rotation, when they made the deal for David Price, you're thinking, well, they still got some bullpen issues, but if all your starters are going 7 or 8 innings in October, I guess it doesn't matter. Obviously, that outlook has changed a little bit with Sanchez out and just the struggles of Verlander. And as you look ahead with this bullpen, they've tried. God bless Dave Dombrowski. He's tried just about everything that's been available out there, whether it be Joel Hanrahan or Jim Johnson or Joaquin Soria, who of course got hurt soon after he was acquired. They made a claim on Chad Qualls on the waiver wire. What's in the midst of that? I guess another issue is Jabba Chamberlain's kind of gone backward in recent weeks. How's the bullpen outlook look? I mean, is this something you think they can piece together down the stretch, or what are your thoughts on that?
I think Jabba's got to be a concern because the Tigers have relied so much on him to really shore up that eighth inning. For as much as has been made, and justifiably so, about Joe Nathan's struggles, Jabba has really been the keystone there. But the problem is he's been so good compared to the rest of the guys, is that that he got used a lot in the first half, and it was a pace as far as appearances that for a guy just a couple years removed from Tommy John surgery, you kind of had to worry about it in the back of your mind, whether he'd be able to pitch that effectively for that long, working as well. And Brad Ausmus tried as best he could to kind of ease off a little bit. He hasn't had quite the same pace lately. Now part of that's been because they hit some struggles and they didn't really have nearly as many leads to protect, but there's outings where he looks normal, at least for this year, and then there's outings where that slider looks a little flat or he's not commanding the ball like he usually does. I think that's something that they have to figure out, because if you're not able to hand it eighth inning in Jabba all the time, how you use the other guys in that bullpen just changes dramatically. And that's even if you get Joaquin Soria back at the level you would expect, depending on how he recovers from that oblique injury and whether he has any setbacks in that throwing program that he's got going on.
Yeah. Like, you had a really interesting article about something that I guess you don't always think about when it comes to a big trade, like the one that the Tigers made to David Price. And there's been talk about Austin Jackson was such a hot bat for them in the leadoff spot in the week or so before that trade. So you think about his impact, the impact of losing him out of that leadoff spot. But you had a piece about the defensive aspect of losing Austin Jackson and Rajay Davis, having the speed, but trying to adjust to reading the balls off the bat. Torrey Hunter called Jackson a pure center fielder, which has a lot of connotations to as far as how you patrol the outfield and how you lead the outfield as well. How do you see Davis settling in there, and how do you see them adjusting to the new reality of a new center fielder on the fly this season?
I think Davis is getting better at it. He's had a couple plays lately where he's had better routes. I think over the weekend at in Minnesota, there was a ball that Plouffe hit to the bullpen fence there in left center, and he took really for him a very direct route. And I wrote about it in that article where he talked about playing them deeper, just watching the swings, and he sounded like a center fielder judging that. And to get him with that mentality, I think, is a big step. The challenge is that Comerica Park is such a challenge for center fielders. For one, it's a huge amount of territory to cover, with the dimensions and with the size of those gaps. But secondly, just with some of the sight lines, as far as some of the backgrounds, over the years, the guys who have played there regularly have consistently said, that there are certain balls at certain times of the day that you just have trouble tracking off the bat, and you kind of have to play catch up once that ball is in the air to kind of get an idea of where it's going and where you have to put yourself. This goes back all the way to the Nook Logan and Curtis Granderson days in the middle of the last decade. Austin Jackson had that challenge too, and it's especially strong in day games. We still have to see if Rajay can handle those. But right now, he looks like the clear-cut regular center fielder. I don't think this is a platoon. I think, they're going to give him this and let him kind of try to grow into the role. And I think he's embracing it right now. He's having some fun doing it. And he's at least trying his best as far as, both learning to position himself to give himself a better chance. And also communicating with those guys in the corners, which is something that Austin was very good about doing.
On a different note, Beck, J.D. Martinez comes out of nowhere to really impact the lineup this season. And you always worry about guys who come out of nowhere, like they'll go back to nowhere. And he struggled out the gate in the second half, but it really seems like he's starting to put it back together at the plate. I know that's huge for that offense.
Yeah, it's kind of a different mode for him right now. I mean, he's still hitting for power, and that's something they desperately need in there. But you're also seeing him, kind of go with pitches and getting some key singles and doubles there. And if he can do that, batting behind Victor Martinez, I think that really rounds out that lineup a lot better. It extends that run production portion of that lineup. I think they're already kind of getting that with Nick Castellanos. What he was doing now in the sixth spot. You do that, you got J.D. Martinez, then instead of looking towards Cabrera and Victor Martinez and saying they have to come through every time, now you're looking at at least those two through six spots, getting some legit production, middle of the order type production, to try to get some runs across. And that's the more consistent they can put runs across, I think the better that rotation is going to be, because they've had an awful lot of 2-1, 2-0, 3-2 games lately. And I think the value of giving these guys like a 5-1 lead or a 6-2, I don't think you can overestimate that.
Yeah, they definitely need to get some stability in general with the run production. And and get the most out of the starters they do have, especially with Sanchez out. So we'll see how that all plays out for the Tigers. And I want to thank Jason Beck for joining us, joined by Jordan Bastian, and talking about Indians team that I, for one, am not ready to bury in the AL Central race, just knowing how crazy this game can be, knowing the Royals have 25 years of more than 25 years of bad luck kind of behind them, hopefully behind them for their sake. But you never know what can rear its ugly head. And the Tigers are really stumbling here in August with all their injuries and uncertainty. So the Indians, meanwhile, starting to put things together in rotation. Trevor Bauer, Carlos Carrasco, and Danny Salazar have all come on strong here in recent outings. And obviously you pair those guys with Corey Kluber and what he's done this year, and things are starting to look up at a good time for them to look up. So bringing Jordan to talk about that. JB, how's that rotation? How much of a surprise is it to see the rotation clicking the way it has at this point? Obviously, they traded Justin Masterson in July, but really, this is the best the rotation has looked all year.
Yeah, I mean, you know, TJ House had a rough one in the opener against the White Sox, only going 4 2/3 and allowing 5 runs. But before that, over about a 2-week stretch, the starting rotation had an ERA of 1.71. You know, I mean, these guys are just, you know, keeping this team right in it, especially with an offense that, I mean, as you well know, is kind of feast or famine, where they might go a week where if you get 2 runs, that's your support, and then they might break out and have a big night, you know, and score 7 or 8. But it's, you know, it's a pretty unpredictable offense. So having that consistent starting pitching of late, you know, has been just a godsend for the Indians. You know, it's something where the rotation numbers as a whole this season aren't that impressive. But when you just filter out the 5 guys that are currently in the staff and you look at their numbers as starting pitchers, I mean, obviously Corey Kluber improves the numbers as a group, but that quintet, you know, is better than the American League average, which I think would surprise a lot of people given the fact that, you know, these aren't household names. I mean, obviously Trevor Bauer's come with some hype over the last few years, but this is his first, you know, semi-full season. Kluber kind of was unheralded going into the year. Carlos Carrasco was a mess until the last month. You know, and TJ House, kind of nobody really thought much of him coming up too. So, yeah, this has been a pretty impressive group. And I'd say right now between the rotation and that bullpen, you know, the Tito's bullpen army, that's why the Indians are still right there on the cusp and why you can't really count them out yet.
Yeah, the bullpen army has been a regular feature of Terry Francona in Cleveland, and I'm sure the bullpen army will grow substantially come September 1st. But that's necessary for this club right now. You mentioned the first game of Chicago series was the start of 30 games in 30 days, which is just brutal, especially with so much on the line. How is Tito going to handle that? How is this team going to handle that? And how big will that bullpen army be in that stretch?
Well, it's funny. The first thing Tito said when we asked him about the 30 games in 30 days was, he said, "I can't wait to have more bodies and more arms." So you know that pitching staff is going to grow. I mean, it seems like they've been running out a 25-man pitching staff all year. You know, and Francona, the way he's been handling it, I mean, he always preaches that every game is as important as the next one and the one before. But you really see and feel that sense of urgency right now where – he's always the guy that's making a lot of pitching changes, but right now if he runs into a jam in the fifth inning, you know, he wants to stop the bleeding, and he might use 4 pitchers in that fifth inning if he feels that inning is the most important for either spreading the game or holding the game right where it is. So you're sensing that sense of urgency from the manager, you know, in the way he's handling his pitchers, and you're also feeling it in the clubhouse. And right now they're running a lot of young guys out there, and sometimes they're featuring as many as 4 rookies in the starting lineup. And I mean, as you've seen with other teams in the past, sometimes when you bring kids up who are on a roll in the minor leagues and then they come up to the big leagues, sometimes they just don't know any better but to play hard and play well and keep a team afloat. And, you know, and rather than play spoiler, in this case, you have a team that is staying right in the thick of things, even though the veterans, you know, a lot of key guys they've been counting on just have not been contributing the way Cleveland would have hoped.
Yeah, those rookies have been interesting to watch. With the rookies come the rookie mistakes, of course. You think about a guy like Kyler Holt running himself into an out a few nights ago on the bases, and you know Jose Ramirez did one of those at home plate a few days ago as well. And
But those guys have actually been fun to watch from my perspective. Zach Walters, for instance, is not exactly hit for average, but it seems like he's had some really timely home runs for them. And Holt obviously has done a lot offensively. How much has that really just been a change in look for the lineup to see these guys thrust into such prominent roles?
Well, I was talking to one of the coaches, third base coach Mike Sarbaugh, recently, who, I mean, he was a minor league manager for a long time in the Indian system. And I said, if I would have written down the lineup you're using today and showed you it in spring training and said it's August 26th or August 25th or whatever, and this is your lineup, you know, where are you in the standings? And he laughed and said, you know, we're last. We're in last place and the season's gone wrong. You know, and that's basically what's been impressive about it is this lineup is, it looks like the AAA Columbus lineup a lot of nights. You know, and obviously you still have some key guys, Santana, Brantley, Kipnis, Michael Bourne recently came back. So it's not like it's without the veterans and guys that are doing stuff. But, you know, for the most part, you know, you're getting a lot of contributions and surprising contributions. Jose Ramirez, who, you know, wasn't even on my radar as a shortstop, you know, has filled in really well and displayed some tremendous range since taking over for Asdrubal Cabrera, who was traded. And obviously Zach Walters, as you mentioned, has come over and, you know, his first six home runs with the team have either tied a game or given the Indians the lead. Ramirez has a walk-off hit. Roberto Perez has stepped in seamlessly since Yan Gomes landed on the concussion DL, served as a starting catcher. And Tyler Holt came through with a pretty big pinch hit, run-scoring, game-winning hit a few games ago, and has been just seemingly diving after every ball in the outfield. So you're seeing that spark that the Indians have hoped for from some surprising sources, and, you know, maybe that, you know, gives a little more confidence to the fan base when you start forecasting for 2015 and 2016, where I think anything you get down the stretch here seems like a gift, and it seems to be laying a pretty solid foundation for the future.
You know, we were talking about the bullpen army a minute ago, and I guess the general of that army has become Cody Allen, who took over the closing duties, I guess, somewhere around Memorial Day. And since that point, he's got an ERA under one. You know, for Indians fans, there's been a lot of kind of hold your breath in the ninth inning over the years when you think about, you know, the Joe Borowskis and Chris Perez's of the world. But Allen's just been just straight up dominant, and that's been such a weapon for Francona to utilize. Is it any surprise to you the way he's gravitated towards that, you know, towards those closing duties?
Not really. I mean, I actually thought they were going to roll the dice and make him the closer at the beginning of the season, but, you know, I could understand both from a developmental and from a financial standpoint why the Indians wanted to delay that move and kind of keep him in that setup role. And they did, Francona really did like using him as sort of that stopper for whatever inning he chooses last season, where, you know, if he felt the eighth inning was set up to be more important than the ninth inning, he liked having Cody Allen for that. But Brian Shaw has kind of stepped into that role and done admirably as well. So, you know, obviously things didn't work out with John Axford. He is in Pittsburgh now. Cody Allen has kind of taken over as the closer. And what's kind of funny about it is they've never come out and said Cody Allen is the closer. And I think still, if you ask Terry Francona, he would still curb his wording there, which is kind of funny because he's the closer. I mean, but it's like he just didn't want to say it. Like that would be pigeonholing Allen into only the ninth inning, you know, when maybe there's something else might come up. And, you know, you've heard Tito talk and the way he approaches that. But, no, I've been very impressed. And I joked with Allen recently. I said, what's with all these, you know, quick ninth innings? We're not used to this. We're used to rewriting our stories. So, you know, but it's been drama-free. And as you said, there's been so much other drama with the Indians this year, so many other things that have had fans, you know, pulling their hair out and being on the edge of their seat, that I'm sure they're thrilled to finally have a closer, knock on wood, who is handling that inning with ease.
Yeah, it's a lot different look. And to your point, there's something about that in this industry where managers are always hesitant to name young guys their closer too early or too prematurely. And kind of reminds me of the 2011 Cardinals with Tony La Russa and Jason Mott, who he wrote in those last couple months of the season all the way to the series title. And I think it was
after Game 7 in the World Series, he finally told him, hey, you're my closer. So,
oh, really?
The Indians hope for, a similar scenario there. But one last thing, JB, totally different note, but it was a really cool thing. You and I both had a chance to get out to League Park, the former home of the Indians in the early 1900s up to they played games there until 1946, and City of Cleveland poured a bunch of money into it to get it to reinvigorate it and have it ready for use in the Cleveland community by little league teams and high school teams and rec teams and whoever else wants to go out and play ball. What was your takeaway from being out there on the opening day?
Not only was the grand opening event just pretty awesome, but the you could tell the facilities were just state of the art, and you know, you could feel the excitement talking to a lot of the fans that came out and seeing all the kids on the field and things like that. I mean, you could tell that neighborhood is really hoping that this is kind of a catalyst for, you know, changing that Huff neighborhood for the better. I mean, this is something where, you know, they're from talking to some of the councilmen, you know, they had a lot of meetings to not only, you know, want to restore the historical side of this, but really put things within the facility in the park that kind of would be kind of a gathering place, you know, whether it's walking on the walking track or bringing the kids out to the little splash pad or having kids play Little League games on that field. And, you know, they have the Baseball Heritage Museum, which is very cool, has moved permanently into the old ticket house. So, I mean, I was really impressed and really blown away by seeing it and getting to walk on that field and to know all the history that took place within those lines and seeing the, you know, that quirky 45, 48-foot wall and, you know, just the strange dimensions. And then seeing Travis Hafner in like a 1920s Cleveland uniform, he looked like he fit right in into the setting. You know, it was a really entertaining opening, and, you know, it was really cool, and I'd encourage any Indians fans or just baseball history fans to head out to East 66 in Lexington and kind of check out what they've done with the place. So, you know, it's really cool, and I was happy to get out there and cover that.
It was the host site for two World Series championship teams, the 1920 Indians and the 1945 Cleveland Buckeyes in the Negro League World Series. So we'll see if Tito Francona and his bullpen army can get Cleveland back to that kind of a stage here in 2014. I want to thank Jordan Bastian for joining us. I'm going to be joined by Scott Merkin, MLB.com's beat writer for the Sox. And, you know, I've been thinking about this White Sox team a little bit lately. The shameless promotion department did an article for Sports on Earth earlier this week looking at there were nine teams kind of in the mix or on pace to potentially lose 90 games this season. I know that's a frustrating year for fans, but you kind of look at that group of clubs and which ones are best positioned to make a big improvement and vie for October next year. I think the Sox are right up there near the top of that list. Think about what Jose Abreu has brought to that lineup. Think about what Adam Eaton has done at the top of that lineup when healthy. You know, with Chris Sale and Jose Quintana, you got a really nice 1-2 punch to the top of rotation. Definitely have to do some things this winter to bridge that gap, but I do think there are some nice pieces in place. And let's bring in Scott Merkin to talk about that. Scott, what's been your take on this season overall, I guess? They've definitely been one of baseball's most improved clubs. I know that doesn't show necessarily in the one-loss record, but what's your feeling, I guess, as we near the home stretch here?
Well, first of all, both the Cubs and Sox need to improve quickly to keep up with Jackie Robinson West Little League, because they are now the baseball stars of Chicago at this moment.
They're the standard bearers, yes.
Exactly. I mean, it all starts with them and then runs down from there pretty much. But you made a very good point in that, you know, the White Sox record, they were pretty much on, like, the edge of the edge of the edge of contention. You know, they were about 6.5 back of the second wild card, but behind 16. So they needed really a almost kind of a miracle to get in. And then they went 2-4 against the Twins and Rangers at home, and that pretty much ended it, and they haven't been very good since then. And I think it's going to be deceiving that they will make progress this year and still could end up losing 87, 88 if things really go sideways, maybe even 90 games
right
this year. But you're exactly right in your column in that, you know, they are in position with another strong offseason with, you know, Rick Hahn and his staff and Kenny Williams and everyone else there, Jerry Reinsdorf, to be in contention this year. In 2015, there's no question about it. I mean, I'm going to miss people when I rattle off the nucleus here, but you have Abreu, Avisaíl García, Adam Eaton, Chris Sale, Jose Quintana, you know, Alexi Ramirez. And then you also have some pieces that if you decide you want to move, such as a Quintana, who's an excellent pitcher, doesn't have much support, probably one of the lowest supported pitchers in baseball, 38 no decisions in the last 2 years. But, I mean, he would draw quite a bit in return, especially if you're planning on, you know, a rotation with Banks, Sale, and Rodon next year. And so would Alexi Ramirez at shortstop. You don't really have a shortstop behind him. But what I'm saying is back to your point, and I forgot Carlos Rodon, of course, who is, you know, probably the top pitching prospect, you know, in the minors right now. You really have some things to build on, and it can turn quick. And I think, you know, with the parity in baseball, you know, Kansas City is a good team. Detroit's a good team, but an older team. I don't think there's that much of a gap between the Sox and the top couple teams that division that they can, you know, go from 89, 90 losses this year to being in contention next year.
Yeah, that's what we're seeing in baseball in general. The rebuilding projects that we're used to aren't necessarily the case. If you have a few nice pieces in your lineup, you can really get things going in a hurry. And yeah, you mentioned Rodon. If he comes up in September, gets that first taste, likely in the bullpen, obviously, but he could be a rotation piece as soon as next year. You know, I wanted to harp on Eaton a little bit. He came back from the oblique injury this week. But you think about what he's done at the top of the order this year. His on-base percentage is about 370, I believe. His strikeout rate is about where it was with the Diamondbacks. It's pretty solid mark, about 15%. His walk rate has gone up. His batting average has shot up about 50 points. What's been their overall impressions of Eaton, what he's brought to the top of the order this year?
Great player, high energy, needs to avoid running into posts in the outfield wall, clearly. But I think, you know, as much as I'm making light of that, which I don't think he made very light of it when he hit it head on, I think it's a learning experience for him that, and he even said that when we talked to him when he came back, that, you know, there are times to go full force and there are times where you may have to pull off at the wall and let the ball go out, that kind of thing. And that's his style of play. One interesting number is that Adam Eaton, Avisaíl García, and Jose Abreu at the start of the Cleveland series had only played 9 games in the same starting lineup this year.
Wow.
So that gives you a little idea as to, you know, why they're probably not going to end up as strong as they could, along with a bullpen that's just not been good this year. And either back in the rotation that didn't do a lot either, although Noesi and Carroll filled in well. But they like that energy from Eaton. This is a team that seems to, I mean, any team in baseball runs better with a good leadoff guy, a good guy that can, you know, really be the catalyst. But the White Sox in general, especially with the middle of the order they should have, seem to, you know, really benefit from a guy on top. But you get guys healthy next year and get 130 games, 135 out of that trio, and, you know, you're moving in the right direction just automatically with just the health factor more than anything else.
García, the first game of that Cleveland series, there was a bloop RBI single for the Indians that, you know, García looked like maybe he had a play on it if you make some ridiculous diving catch, but he kind of let it fall in front of him, and I know that gave up a run, but I also thought it was a little mature on his part, you know, to not push it in that instance, knowing how quickly he came back from that shoulder situation that was supposed to cost him the rest of the season. So might have given up a run there, but might have also saved some bullets, so he can still get some time here down the stretch, no?
Yeah, the only limitation that he was set on when he came back from the torn labrum and the avulsion fracture that he suffered when he was diving for a ball in Colorado on April 9th was that he could no longer dive head first. And he's done a good job about that. He slid a couple times. He slid feet first on the base pass. He slid you know, in the outfield feet first, and he's learning. You know, and he's – you can see it. And it's funny, not just from the naked eye, just from watching him, but you look at the quotes from the other managers that they've played since he's been back, and they're all – you know, they all just kind of marvel at him. And Terry Francona even said that when he saw the Sox pick him up last year in the Jake Peavy trade, he was amazed. He was impressed. That's a pretty good addition right there. And again, you put those guys in the middle of the lineup, Abreu and García, and whoever else they add in there. You know, this Andy Wilkins kid's had a great year in AAA Charlotte, and I have a feeling he'll get a look in September. Maybe he could be a piece that you could add for a little bit, you know, lower cost as a DH and then go spend the money in the bullpen or another pitcher. But, you know, you have a healthy García and a guy who I think has really learned, as you said, Anthony, from that injury. You know, I think he's really – it matured him in a hurry. Not that he wasn't mature to begin with, but, I mean, it turned a young player into kind of a veteran, just that kind of experience, taking the game away from him for a little bit that he loves so much and brought him back, and he understands what he has to do to kind of stay under control out in the field a little bit more.
Yeah. Mark, obviously so much focus on the future and talk about the future, but a big piece of the past is bidding adieu here in Paul Konerko. And it was a really cool moment in New York last weekend where the two captains kind of saluting each other and Jeter presenting Konerko, Derek Jeter presenting Konerko with the base autographed by the Yankees. And obviously Jeter's farewell tour getting a lot more attention than Konerko's, but I guess there'll be more of those kind of sentimental moments here in the last month of the season as Konerko, you know, makes his last visits to the AL Central stops where he's done so much damage over the years.
Yeah, exactly. They're going to probably, you know, bid him farewell and say, don't let the door hit you as you're walking out of here at Comerica Park with your 50 career home runs here or whatever. No, I think, you know, everyone has a great appreciation for the way Paul Konerko has carried himself, the leadership he's shown, the professional way that he goes about his business. And, you know, you talked to Robin about that, and Paul is, by the way, perfectly fine without, you know, a big farewell tour. He's gotten the numbers 1 and 4 from the Wrigley Field scoreboard when they played the Cubs for the final time, and then Jeter gave him the base, which is a great move, and the Sox did the same thing where they hit Konerko, give Jeter the gift when he was here in Chicago for the last time. But, you know, Robin said, if you notice how, like, other players will come up to him during batting practice and kind of wish him well, or other coaches, other managers, and I think you hit the nail right on the head in that in the last month when he goes to these ballparks, when he goes to Minnesota and Detroit and Cleveland and Kansas City for the first time, I think you'll see some sort of recognition there. And, you know, he's not looking for it, but he appreciates it. And, you know, the Sox are doing a big thing in September. It's kind of Paul Konerko month. They're having a special section, you know, just in honor of his last month, special section of the season, the outfield built around the one blue seat where he hit the grand slam off Chad Quarles in the 2005 World Series. So, you know, unfortunately for them, they're not going to be playing for anything barring a great finish to get to 500, but they're going to have a lot of individual things to look at, and one of them is going to be Paul Konerko's farewell in the last few weeks of the season.
Yeah. Merck, one last thing real quick. I mean, you mentioned that 05 World Series, and I know it's apples and oranges, but the Jackie Robinson West surge there, did that have shades of 05 there on the south side as far as people getting wrapped up in that?
It really is crazy. You saw the Blackhawks got the huge response. The Sox were, you know, obviously it was crazy, 2 million people in 05 for their parade. But people have really taken this team, I think, just because, you know, it's kind of baseball at its purest form. You know, they're just playing hard, trying to win for themselves, but also representing the city. And, you know, it hasn't been, just like every big city, there's been some crime here that's been kind of sad, you know, kind of sad story over the last, you know, few months, a year. And I think this is just kind of uplifting for everyone. And it's a good push for baseball. It was just fun baseball watching as the ratings proved out, just watching them get to the championship. I mean, even though they lost to South Korea, you know, they achieved their goal. They are the U.S. champion and, you know, really represented Chicago very well.
Yeah, they represented baseball very well. And obviously that's a big deal in baseball to see baseball, you know, resonates so well in the inner city as well. So,
and by the time I think six kids on that team were from the White Sox, great amateur city elite youth baseball program. So it's serving its purpose well, clearly.
And then Jerry Reinsdorf, I think he told you, I look at this as a White Sox team. So yeah, that was great stuff. I want to thank Scott Merkin for joining us. About to be joined by Rhett Bollinger, the Twins beat writer for MLB.com, and talk about a Twins team that, as we near the end of this season, it's been an important season for them as far as a stepping stone back towards contention. And, you know, they've seen some good strides in the rotation, particularly from Phil Hughes, starting to see some young talent, you know, impact things at the big league level a little bit. Let's bring Rhett to talk about that. Rhett, first of all, I think, you know, the biggest name in the system, obviously, is Byron Buxton, and it's been a tough year for him and for Miguel Sano. They both basically lost a season of development because of injuries, but sounds like they got some good news with Buxton going to participate in the Arizona Fall League. That'll be big for him, won't it?
Yeah, absolutely. That's really big news. I mean, he had this concussion here in mid-August. It seems like he'll be good to go then by October when the Fall League starts. I think it starts on October 7th. You know, the Twins are a little bit worried how he'd, you know, recover from that. It was definitely a big collision, but so far, from what I've been told from the Twins, you know, the concussion actually, luckily, was kind of minor despite that, you know, big collision. He's really only had some small headaches here and there, hasn't had any of the problems with, you know, the sensitivity of the light or sound, that kind of thing. So the Twins are happy with that, and, you know, he's feeling healthy enough, they were able to put him on the Fall League roster, so it's definitely good news for Buxton.
Obviously, Ray, you're around the big league clubs, so you're not around Buxton himself during the season, but you do have to wonder, like, how this year has affected him mentally, you know. Maybe this will be a good thing for him in the long run, everything he's gone through. Make him appreciate all the more, if, you know, if and when he does get to the big leagues. But I'd have to imagine this has been a frustrating season for him with all that's gone on.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, to play only one game in Double A, you know, to finally get up there, let in that collision, and obviously miss, you know, a lot of time with the two wrist injuries. It's been a tough season for him. You know, I think there are people who are hopeful that maybe he could start off strong at Double A and then, you know, get to the majors this year. But instead he had the wrist injury and started in Single A instead of Double A. And yeah, he's kind of had a setback here. But I think you're right. I think it kind of helps to maybe savor it later, you know, when he gets up here to the big leagues. I don't think, you know, I talked to Terry Ryan about it. He didn't want to call it a lost season only because, you know, he's learned so much, you know, from the injuries, that kind of stuff. And sure, I do think that the fall league will definitely help him here coming here in October to get some good competition and see how he does.
Yeah. Obviously, they, you know, Buxton is kind of penciled in as a center fielder of the future, but the guy playing center field right now is pretty darn good. And that's Danny Santana, who last week, him and his teammate Trevor Plouffe were players of the week in the AL. It's nice to see them get that recognition, and particularly Santana. He's had a terrific rookie year. And I know there's some question about, you know, getting him in the mix at shortstop, and I know they've tried to do that here and there. What's the outlook for him position-wise? Is shortstop going to be the focus next season, do you think?
I think so. I mean, he's been a big surprise for this team. Obviously, he was a top prospect, but no one really thought he was going to hit like this, you know. Definitely thought people he's more of a speedster, but he's been hitting for high average pretty much all year. Like you said, he was just the player of the week there with Plouffe. But I do think next year they want to get him at shortstop. Maybe he'll start the year at center field again. Obviously, I don't think Buxton's going to make the roster out of opening day at all. I think there's no chance of that. So they still might need a center fielder unless, you know, I'm guessing that Aaron Hicks will be called up here in September to see how he does. But I do think that the position of the future for Santana is definitely shortstop. It's just the kind of the Twins have had Eduardo Escobar also have a very surprising season at shortstop, too. So the good thing for the Twins is they actually have some options now up the middle, which is definitely something for them moving forward.
Yeah, obviously you don't expect Santana to sustain the batting average he's supposed to hear in about 70 or 80 games. But you look at his numbers, he's really cut down on his strikeout rate from the minor leagues. He's getting on base even more frequently than he did in the minor leagues. How sustainable do they think this stuff is?
That's a good question. I mean, the big thing I think Terry Ryan's always told me with Santana is he's such a good bat control. But I think he sees more pitches around the zone because, you know, the pitchers are just better at locating. And he's able to put the balls in play and hit them hard. And, you know, he has so much speed. And if he gets it on the ground, he can beat it out. So I think that maybe he's helped by that in the majors, that pitchers are around the zone more. He's definitely a swinger, doesn't walk too much. But you are right. I mean, the strikeout-to-walk ratio isn't very good. And generally, over time, that comes back to bite you a little bit. You know, he can regress back to the mean. And his batting average on balls in play, or his BABIP, I guess you call it, is pretty high, too. We never know how sustainable that is. But he definitely makes a lot of hard contact, doesn't strike out too much, and definitely is, you know, a speedster that can get on base even with a little ground ball. So I do think he can probably hit close to 300. Even with the minors last year, I think he hit like 290. So I think the average can be there. I just wonder how much of that power and the doubles power even, because his slugging percentage is pretty high this year too, how high that can all also stay going forward.
Yeah. I remember hearing some things earlier in the year. He was a little uncomfortable in center field, which is understandable. He hadn't played it much. Have you seen him grow defensively as the season's gone along?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, there's still some times where he takes a bad route. The biggest thing with him is his speed kind of allows him to make up for some of those bad routes that he takes because, yeah, the repetition just hadn't really been there. He played there a little bit in the minor leagues, but really played mostly shortstop coming up. So for him to kind of make that switch, I remember early in the season when I did it, I was surprised. I thought, wow, I didn't realize Santana could play, you know, center field. I thought, okay, maybe he'll play out there maybe for a week or two. He'd kind of fill in here and there, kind of the stopgap bases, kind of. But so far, he's handled it well. Like I said, he's not an elite center fielder or anything yet, but with that speed, he's got a great throwing arm. He's fared just fine out there. He definitely can get better. I think he has been getting better. But, yeah, it's definitely impressive the way he's been able to fit in out there.
Right. You mentioned Aaron Hicks earlier and obviously struggles at the big league level. He's played pretty well since going down to Rochester. Is he a guy we might see come September as a call-up?
I do think so, yeah. I think the Twins want to get another look at him. He has been playing, you know, he's played really well at Double A. They sent him down there to kind of, you know, totally, you know, refocus, reset maybe, and played really well at Double A, which he should have. You know, I mean, he's better than that Double A competition right now. And Triple A has played well too, so I do think he'll be up here. The Twins want to see what they have in him. He's still, you know, young. I think he's only 24, so it's not like he's a lost cause. A lot of guys have struggled, you know, early in their career, you know, without kind of figuring it out. I mean, obviously, Torrey Hunter, the Twins is an example of that. It took him a while to kind of figure it out, coming up and down a lot early in his career, too. So it's not like it's unheard of for a guy to struggle early. go down and figure it out. So I think the Twins still have some high hopes for him. I think the big thing with him right now is they're trying to get him to play a little bit of the corner outfield spots too, just because, like we talked about, you know, Buxton's the center fielder of the future, not Hicks. So I think the Twins are trying to see if he can handle, you know, left and right field, which he should, because Hicks is a good center fielder defensively. I don't think the Twins really have any problem with his defense. It's just, you know, his offense so far. And it's been a weird year for him when he drops switch hitting, and now he's doing it again. But the good news is he's seeing results in the minors. I do think the Twins will give him a good look up here in September.
Yeah, sometimes those up and downs, like we say with Buxton with the injuries, sometimes those help you learn in the long run. But another guy obviously is going to be a lot of interest come September is Alex Meyer, and whether or not they call him up. I know they're being careful with his innings with the past shoulder issues, and maybe it would just be out of the bullpen. But what's your gut feeling on whether or not we see him next month?
I think we could. I think it'd maybe be in a relief role, though. I don't think there's any chance he'd come up here to start. I think because you're right with the innings limit and all that, and even the pitch limit. I mean, he's been throwing a limit of about – sometimes he goes over it, depending on how the game goes and if they're easy innings. But he generally only throws 80 to 85 pitches a game, too, just to kind of, you know, be cautious, that kind of thing. So I can't imagine they're going to bring him up here to start and throw, you know, 85 pitches and take him out after, you know, four or five innings. But I do think maybe get him a taste up here, put him in the bullpen. But I could also see them being conservative and not doing that to go to. But I'd be excited to see him in the bullpen. I mean, he's already throwing 100 miles per hour as a starter. I'd love to see what he could do in one inning stints like that. We saw that in the Futures game. I think he threw four pitches and got out of the inning. So it would be fun to see him. My gut feeling is still kind of more maybe 60-40 or even 50-50. It really is tough to tell the Twins want to do with him right now. But I think the fans would definitely be excited if he come out of the bullpen and get some, you know, taste of the majors here.
Well, the Twins obviously trying to end a run of 90 lost seasons, which you can't keep watching those pile up. They're kind of on the cusp of that this year, and it's led to a lot of discussion, obviously, about Ron Gardenhire looking ahead to next year. There's been kind of, I wouldn't say conflicting reports, but there are some reports, I guess, that are stronger than others as far as him coming back next year. He's under contract, so that's a big part of it too, I'm sure. But is that just something they'll revisit at the end of the year? Terry Ryan and Ron Gardenhire sit down and talk it through?
Yeah, exactly. What happened was, you know, Terry Ryan did make remarks to the Star Tribune saying that Gardenhire would be back next year. But the next day, Terry talked to us and told us, you know, he didn't retract his statement, but that really that statement, you know, wasn't really set in stone. He hadn't even met with Gardenhire yet about his status. That's something they always do at the end of the season. It was the same thing last year. You know, the end of the season, you know, we had a lot of questions for both of them about whether or not Gardenhire would come back because he wasn't under contract. And they kept telling us, no, we'll meet at the end of the season, we'll figure it out. And sure enough, they met the last day of the season, and Gardenhire said he wanted to come back, and Terry brought him back, and they had a press conference 2 days later. So I'm expecting the same thing will happen this year. Terry, at the end of the season, will sit down with Gardy and see what he wants to do. I don't think there's really any chance, unless they really, you know, tank down the stretch, that they'd fire Gardenhire or ask him to leave. I honestly think the only way that he would leave would be on his own terms. If he just realized, you know, that all this, you know, losing and struggles has kind of worn him over the years. And the fact that, you know, next year, nothing's guaranteed in terms of obviously only one more year left on his deal. Even if they have a good season, who's to say they're going to bring him back? So you never know if he wants to be, I guess, lame duck manager, where you have only 1 year and you don't really know if there's anything beyond that. Maybe he's just, you know, seen enough of it. But I still think my gut feeling is, just from being around Terry Ryan a lot this season and obviously in the last couple of seasons, I think Gardy's going to come back for one more. And I do think that he'll definitely, if he doesn't, I think it'll be his call and not really the Twins. I don't think there's any chance Terry or anybody asked him to step down or that they fire him.
Yeah, I think their loyalty to Gardenhire these last few years has been refreshing. It's been an acknowledgement that these teams were not exactly built to win in the present tense. And obviously Gardenhire and Mike Socha, the two longest tenured skippers in the big leagues, have afforded rare long leashes. But yeah, we'll see. I think you're right, Red. I think ultimately this could be Gardenhire's decision. So we'll see how that all shakes out. But I want to thank Red for joining us. All right, that's a wrap. We want to thank you for listening. We want to thank all of our beat writers for joining in, Dick Cagle, Jason Beck, Jordan Bastian, Scott Merkin, and Rhett Bollinger. I'm Anthony Kastrovitz, and we'll see you next time.